Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. What's that, you say? The stock market? I mean, yes, sure, but really there is other stuff you need to know today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York today, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 10th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. And look, I get it. I know it's unnerving. An 831-point drop on the Dow, all three major indices down more than 3% today. But about which, there are two things to say. First of all, markets go down as well as up, especially after they had been going up so far so quickly. That is an important point and completely normal. Number two, there are a lot of reasons why this is happening. Chief, probably among them, the quickly rising yields, that is interest rates in the bond market, that we have been telling you about the last 10 days or so, and concurrent murmurings about inflation. All of the above, I have to say again, are normal, but admittedly off-putting when interest rates have been so low for so long and markets have mostly gone up. What is interesting, though, is how what's been going on in this economy's financial markets is affecting the rest of the world. Case in point, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and the Chinese currency today. In an interview this morning, Mnuchin warned Beijing against what he called competitive devaluations of the yuan. That's the Chinese currency. That is, China trying to get a global trade edge by making its currency and therefore its goods cheaper for others to buy. Think trade war and tariffs here. And we should point out that the yuan is about 10% cheaper today than it was last spring. But as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, that might have more to do with what's going on here than what the Chinese are doing.
The yuan has been losing value against the dollar. But you know what? It's had lots of friends on that journey.
The dollar is strong against the euro and the yen and the Canadian dollar and Norway and Sweden and almost all the currencies in the world.
Mark Chandler is the chief market strategist at Bannockburn Global Forex.
I don't think I need a separate, like, explanatory framework to explain China.
Yes, China's economy isn't growing as fast as it once was. And
there's concern about the heavy debt burden that's been taken on by local governments and banks. Lots of bad loans.
So that's definitely a part of the yuan's depreciation. But mostly,
everyone wants the dollar.
Steve Henke at Johns Hopkins University says, if anything, the Chinese have tried to keep the value of the yuan from falling further. They're not working to make it cheaper.
They haven't done anything any differently than they've been doing for a long time.
The dollar is like this glowing orb drawing people in thanks to a strong U.S. economy and rising interest rates that are tempting investors with higher returns. But as the yuan falls, it does have this effect that the Trump administration doesn't love. Ishwar Prasad is a trade policy professor at Cornell.
Some of the tariff measures that the Trump administration has put on imports in China now are much less potent. In other words, a 10% tariff on Chinese imports doesn't amount to much if the Chinese currency depreciates by almost an identical amount.
Prasad thinks Mnuchin was trying to warn China not to get any ideas about using its currency as a weapon in the country's ongoing trade war. Chinese officials said yesterday they have no intention of devaluing their currency. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
While the Treasury Secretary and the foreign exchange markets and tariffs and the trade war get all the headlines, there is another way the United States interacts with the global economy that's at least as significant, and it fits under the general heading of regulatory review. The White House said this morning, and this has bipartisan backing in Congress, it should be said, but the White House announced that the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS as it's called, is going to start taking a much closer look at foreign investment in the United States. Janet Babin has that one.
The new rules are meant to protect our national security. They'll apply when a foreign firm or individual tries to invest in certain sensitive areas, such as technology, everything from aircraft parts makers to AI to semiconductor makers, read lots of Chinese companies, but also other kinds of companies, says Gregory Hussisian, a partner at law firm Foley and Lardner.
Financial institutions, insurance companies, money transmitting companies, they're all going to have a more probing scrutiny of their sales.
These firms will now have to alert CFIUS about any potential foreign investment or face civil penalties. The agency will have to sift through thousands of additional filings. A lot more work when it's already lacking, some say, enough resources to get its job done. More work, too, for foreign companies that want to invest here. Tony Fratto is a former Bush administration official, now at consulting firm Hamilton Place Strategies. He says the tightening up and additional powers for CFIUS could have a chilling effect.
I do think that maybe their charge has gone too far.
Fratto says foreign investment dollars could be redirected to Europe or Asia.
And those investment dollars go other place, then we are actually strengthening our competitors and in some cases our national security foes.
Which would defeat the purpose of these new, stricter regulations. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, as I said, not so good. Also, remember I mentioned people are starting to get worried about inflation. We get numbers on prices at the consumer level. It's called the Consumer Price Index, technically, tomorrow morning. So there is that to look forward to. Stocks way down on this Wednesday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the few things that Republican and Democratic political professionals agree on is that the midterm elections 27 days hence are going to turn on turnout. And in the weeks left, no small fraction of the record amounts that are going to be raised and spent on this election is going to be directed firmly at getting out the vote, with one especially elusive group in mind. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Several times a week, a couple dozen volunteers gather at the historic Women's National Democratic Club in Washington, D.C. They sit at a long, U-shaped table and do their part to get out the vote.
I volunteered more this midterm season than I have in any other election.
On the day I visit, Nicole Poindexter is handwriting postcards to potential voters. Yes, handwriting postcards that have the outline of the state of Virginia, which is just across the river.
Dear fellow Democrat, we need your vote to flip the 5th on November 6th. This election is so important and your voice is more important.
That fellow Democrat's name and address may well have come from a list of likely voters, people who have voted before. Lots of get-out-the-vote money is aimed at getting those voters to show up on Election Day. But that money could be better spent elsewhere, says Clarissa Martinez. She's vice president of Unidos US, a nonprofit that focuses on boosting Latino political engagement.
So what you see is that this vast majority of resources actually chases highly habitual voters first and foremost.
When what you really need to do, says Martinez, is bring in new voters.
For young voters and for communities like the Latino community, they simply don't end up making the outreach target of many of those campaigns.
And that neglect shows up at the polls. Only 20% of those 18 to 29 years old voted in the last midterm in 2014, which is one reason social media is full of ads like this one from Knock the Vote, where aging baby boomers mock younger voters.
If the weather is nice, maybe you could go to one of those little marches.
You might even share this video on Facebook.
But you won't vote. We'll be there. But you won't.
Well, actually, they might. And not just because many races are so tight political parties can't afford to ignore younger voters, but because this time around, many young voters refuse to be ignored. Vote them out. The rallying cry from the March for Our Lives following the Parkland shooting. Youth registration spiked after the protests, and those young voters mean business. In a new poll by Deep Breath, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, 34% of 18 to 24-year-olds said they are extremely likely to vote in the midterms. Some of that energy is a response to the political environment, but there's also money behind it, mostly from the left.
Our program is over $30 million, and a good chunk of that is being spent on field organizing, on the ground, face-to-face conversations with young people.
Ben Wessels with progressive group Next Gen America, he says his outreach budget this year is more than double what it was in 2014. Outreach aimed at people like the friends of 21-year-old Skylar Reinhart, who lives in Northern Virginia. Reinhart is registered to vote, but many of his friends aren't.
I just don't think they're that engaged in the political sphere. Honestly, a lot of them are grinding pretty hard right now at jobs out of school.
Even so, NextGen says it's already signed up more than 230,000 young voters across the political spectrum. Mike Duhaime is a Republican strategist with the public affairs firm Mercury.
I think you're seeing new registrations for both parties at a higher clip than I've seen in a midterm in a long time.
He says the GOP hopes to pull in younger voters along with everyone else, but some campaigns are also focusing on places like college campuses and high schools.
There's no one size fits all, but you do see whether it's activities at local events or fairs, mailings to voters who've just turned 18.
NextGen's Wessel says the increased attention and funding is a recognition that the old strategy wasn't working.
Saying, look, our job needs to be to register, motivate, and turn out younger people rather than chase the same people who live in like six counties in central Ohio.
But registration is one thing. Election day is another. And the real test will come when it's time to show up and vote. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This is going to sound a little cynical, and I suppose in a way it is, but that doesn't make it not true. Kids, and I'm talking really young kids here, are a market. They're a market that can be catered to, that content can be created for, and from which profit can be made. The corporate example at hand is YouTube and its influence on the youngest of consumers. Alexis Madrigal is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His most recent piece is called Raised by YouTube. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to me about how you came to work on this story.
I have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. I've seen toddler YouTube, and I was like, what are all of these things? It's all these brands I've never heard of. It's all these companies all over the world. And I watched my daughter becoming totally absorbed in this kind of animation that to me looks kind of pre-Pixar, if you know what I mean.
Huh. Okay, lots to unpack in there, because the idea, first of all, of toddler YouTube, what is that? Is it as it sounds?
So there are channels on YouTube that are built specifically for, you know, 1-year-olds, 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, and that's what I call toddler YouTube, and it's this kind of but wild place.
Well, I almost don't even know what to say. The premise here is that really young kids in this economy have tablets and phones, and they're on them almost as much as adults, it kind of seems.
Absolutely. I mean, YouTube is by far the most popular brand among children, and even little children have their own favorites. So one of the biggest brands within this space is called Choo Choo TV.
Yeah.
They have 19 billion views. They have 29 million subscribers. This is a global children's entertainment brand.
Wow.
And kids love it. They can't get enough. They watch them over and over and over and over.
All right, so maybe I'm being naive here, but back with the analogy you make in this piece is to PBS and public broadcasting and Sesame Street and Children's Television Workshop from like 50 years ago now in the American economy. And the ostensible reason for all of that was to educate not necessarily 1- and 2-year-olds, but, you know, slightly older toddlers and give them a leg up. Is that the mission of toddler YouTube and Choo Choo TV? Is that what they're doing?
You know, I think right now they're in a transitional place. They've been entertainment. They've been just trying to capture as much children's attention as they possibly can. And now they've realized that they've done that and they need to deliver them something better. And so what I'm hoping is that this global phenomenon of all these video producers on YouTube will have a similar revelation and do similar work to create, you know, YouTube that's good for kids rather than just something that sucks up their time.
Well, so spitball it for me. Do you think that's going to work? Because, you know, not to make the American analogy on everything here, but there were researchers and educators and government regulators in some sense talking to the folks who were doing Children's Television Workshop. Is there a sense that there's that infrastructure beneath what toddler YouTube is doing?
Not really. On the other hand, they can benefit from, you know, 50 years of research on children's television, but the media environment, the media business is obviously much different. And the biggest difference is there's just YouTube, basically. This is where kids are going. This is where the whole business is. And so YouTube itself would have to be the one that sort of maybe tipped the scales for educational content within the algorithms that determine what people watch.
What do we know? What do we think it's actually doing to the kids? Setting aside for a minute whatever educational benefit they might have, we know what being attached to our phones and our screens does to grownups. What about the kids, young kids?
Well, I think, you know, the worst possible impact is that essentially the kind of attention-grabbing, fast-paced content and the ability to switch between those things very quickly may be setting kids up to expect a kind of pacing that's actually not educational. And that's kind of the big worry, that we sort of induce kind of attentional loss in kids.
Alexis Madrigal, he writes for The Atlantic. His most recent piece is called Raised by YouTube. It's kind of fascinating. Alexis, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up,
a huge part of the music industry is the other side of the industry, not just the recorded music side, but the live side.
Nothing beats live shows and the money they make. But first, let's do the numbers. Been a while since we've had the Wawas, huh? Dow Industrial's off 831 points on this Wednesday. That's 3.1%, 25,598. The NASDAQ down 315 points, 4% there, 75.64. S&P 500 fell 94 points, 3.2%, ended at 27.85. I'm going to say this one more time. Markets go down too, peeps. Sears tumbled more than 16% today after reports that the troubled department store has hired an advisory firm to prepare a bankruptcy filing. More on that one coming up. Macy's swung down 0.8%. JCPenney improved about 6.5% today. Insurance stocks suffered as Hurricane Michael made landfall in Florida. Allstate down 3.5%. Travelers off 2.5% today. Berkshire Hathaway gave back 4.9%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Among the many, many, many losers on Wall Street today, as I said, was a company that trades under the ticker symbol SHLD, the Sears Holding Group. Shares hit a record low this morning on news from the Wall Street Journal that the company has hired advisors to start pulling together a bankruptcy filing. Now, Sears' struggles aren't new, right? There's been turnaround after turnaround going on for decades. Now, Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains how a company once the epitome of American retail lost its way.
Sears has been around since the 1890s, and for a long time, it was where you went to buy everything, toys, appliances, clothing. But in the 60s, Walmart and Target opened their doors and sold a lot of the same stuff.
So all of a sudden, they had massive amounts of new competition.
Randy Allen teaches management at Cornell. In 2005, Sears merged with Kmart. The plan was to reinvent the two struggling retail chains, and Allen says that takes a lot of money.
You need to invest money in the stores, in marketing, in people. But the two companies weren't generating sufficient cash.
Over the years, management focused on cutting costs. Sears closed thousands of stores and sold off popular brands like its Craftsman Tools line. Robert Rostin is a principal at Training the Street.
Every time they did something like this, it was oriented around stabilizing cash flows and getting the ship on the right course.
Rostin says ultimately Sears CEO Eddie Lampert cut too much and didn't invest enough. Mark Cohen, a Columbia Business School professor and former CEO of Sears Canada, says the business suffered.
Stores get shabby and dark and dingy and worn out, and then they become less and less likely as destinations for customers to shop.
Sales at Sears have been falling for 6 years. The company is $5.6 billion in debt, and deals with Land's End and Amazon haven't saved the company from where it is today, on the brink of bankruptcy. I'm Mariel Segarra from Marketplace.
We With a nod to the fact that nominations for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame came out this week, there is an economic reality here that needs to be recognized. According to the ratings people at Nielsen, who looked at digital and physical album sales as well as streaming numbers, hip-hop and R&B have replaced rock as this country's most popular music genres. But as so often happens, there is a twist, because what Nielsen didn't consider is how much money people spend on concerts. And when it comes to live shows, rock and roll is still the king. Rock concerts accounted for more than half of the $5 billion generated by last year's highest grossing live tours. Neil Shah wrote about rock and revenue for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
When was the last time you were at a rock concert?
Probably pretty recently. I went to a show at the Warsaw to see a band called Always, along with Snail Mail and Hatchie.
Okay, so it will surprise nobody listening to this program that I don't know who any of those bands are. But but it gets to the point of that's where the money is, really.
Right. Hip-hop and R&B have been dominant culturally for many years now. Commercially speaking, rap has really taken over the industry over the last couple of years. So there tends to be this huge focus, rightly so, on rap and its importance right now. But the thing is, a huge part of the music industry is the other side of the industry, not just the recorded music side, but the live side. And something that's kind of been kind of obscured lately is how significant rock still is for live music.
Is it just because rock and roll has been around so much longer than rap and hip hop and all the rest?
There are several reasons. Rock also crosses generations in a way that rap doesn't. At a rock concert, you could have a younger millennial, a Gen Z music fan who's curious about a particular act. And then, of course, you're going to get 20-somethings, 30-somethings, 40-somethings, 50-somethings. But it's more complicated than that. Guns N' Roses, an older act from the 80s, from the 80s and 90s,
yes.
Guns N' Roses is playing stadiums and is playing arenas. Public Enemy, NWA, also from the 80s, are not. So one significant thing is some of the classic legacy pioneering rap acts aren't playing big venues.
All right. A lot of questions actually come out of that. The first is going to a live show is a disposable income kind of thing, right? Do rock and roll show fans tend to have more disposable income than the folks who would go to see, say, NWA?
It is the case that those younger fans of hip hop have less disposable cash. So what happens is the economics for an act like Juice WRLD, who's on top of the charts with this song Lucid Dreams right now, are different. If you had this lengthy, sprawling tour hitting a second tier, third tier cities across the U.S., it's not going to work because there aren't going to be enough people to come to that show. Whereas maybe a rock act who has older fans with more cash in their pocket could make the economics work.
So let's go back even farther. Eventually, Mick Jagger is going to die.
Right.
And eventually, rock and roll fans now who are 50 and 60 and remembering it from their youth are going to stop going. Is that going to change the dynamic?
Many people I've talked to feel like this is an elephant in the room for the live music industry. And once the Rolling Stones and the Paul McCartneys go, it is a question, can the newer acts replace the older acts? And can the newer acts in their old age generate the kind of money that the Stones do? Remember, the Rolling Stones back in the 70s, they didn't make that much money from albums and even live. They make more money now than they ever did back in the day.
Wow.
So the question is that a historical anomaly tied to rock in the 20th century or not? And one way that the industry is shifting is placing a little bit more focus on festivals and on smaller venues.
Right. And then you roll all of that in with streaming and subscription downloads and other ways that people can get it besides a live event.
Right.
And it all changes.
Right.
Neil Shah at the Wall Street Journal. Neil, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
This final note on the way out today, in which the future of healthcare is revealed, or, well, okay, that's not entirely true, but it's a hint anyway. This morning, the Department of Justice gave a preliminary go-ahead to CVS, the pharmacy chain, buying the insurance giant Aetna for a tidy $69 billion American money. Could turn out to be a big deal. and how people get their healthcare. Actually, imagine a pharmacy for a second, not just as a place you go to get toothpaste, but with an in-house clinic, perhaps, some kinds of routine treatments as well. It's a pharmacy benefits company owning an insurance company. All right, we are on our way. The Dow Industrial is off 831 points today. That is 3 1/10%. NASDAQ down 315. That is 4%. S&P 500 off 94 points, 3 2/10%. There, remember, the CPI, Consumer Price Index, tomorrow, inflation at the consumer level. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.